Hey everyone, I'm Thanos Davelis, and welcome back to The Greek Current, a podcast by the Hellenic American Leadership Council and Kathimerini, where we highlight the top stories of the day every afternoon with analysis from guest experts, policymakers, journalists, and HELC staff. In 2021, we saw Turkey slowly work to reduce tensions with a number of its regional rivals, including Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. While Turkey seems eager to move from active confrontation towards greater stability, its rivals have not all embraced rapprochement with the same zeal as Ankara. The question now remains how far regional dynamics will shift given the many underlying fault lines that remain. Expert Nicholas Danforth joins The Greek Current to talk about his latest policy brief for ELYAMEP, the Hellenic Foundation for European and Foreign Policy, which explores Turkey's efforts over the past year to mend relations with its rivals in the Eastern Mediterranean and the Gulf, and share his thoughts on what we should expect moving forward. Nicholas Danforth is a non-resident senior research fellow at ELYAMEP and the author of the book, The Remaking of Republican Turkey, Memory and Modernity. Nicholas, welcome back on The Greek Current. It's great to have you with us.
Great to be back.
Over the past year, we've watched Turkey take steps to reduce tensions with regional rivals like Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. Looking back at 2021, how would you rate the success of these diplomatic efforts?
What stands out looking back is that so much of the way we think about this has been shaped by what strikes me as the remarkably overenthusiastic assessments that a lot of people in Ankara were putting out at the beginning of the year. When you look at how much progress has been made in some absolute terms, you know, it's not that bad, given how bad relations were to start out with. But compared to some of the sometimes outlandish, overenthusiastic claims we were hearing from Turkish government officials in particular, you know, that there was going to be a reset with Biden, everything was going to be going swimmingly with all of Turkey's former adversaries, they were going to sign a maritime deal with Israel and Egypt. You know, it was by the standards of what some of the propaganda we were getting, you know, it's obviously fallen far short. And it obviously varies by country. Certainly the visit of the UAE Crown Prince to Ankara, you know, that was something real. That was surprising. That was more direct, real rapprochement than some of us were expecting. On the other hand, things with Egypt have moved much slower than Ankara clearly wanted. Certainly with the United States, there hasn't been any market improvement. Israel, right as we were getting some new optimism out of Ankara, the government arrested two Israeli tourists on fairly ridiculous charges. That crisis was smoothed over, but, you know, we haven't seen any major breakthroughs. We might get some more progress with Saudi Arabia, probably. You know, again, slow steps to normalization are possible. You know, you're talking at the level of sending an ambassador back to Israel or Egypt. You know, that kind of thing could happen in the coming year. But what I tried to emphasize in talking about this is that the fault lines that were there a year ago remain, and they're not, you know, Turkey's efforts at rapprochement have cooled tensions. I have certainly lowered the possibility of direct armed conflict, which I think we're all relieved about. But again, they haven't made this regional realignment go away. They haven't overcome, you know, the real differences that Turkey had with a lot of its neighbors.
These efforts are undoubtedly also linked to Erdogan's continued domestic struggles, where he faces unprecedented political challenges. With that in mind, is this more a question of Erdogan seeing how far the rhetoric of rapprochement can take him?
Right, and that's clearly a lot of the optimism we heard from Ankara at the outset of the year was a response to the difficulties that Erdogan's government found itself in. You know, the economy has been getting steadily worse for years now, but it's particularly bad now. I've seen a huge spike in the exchange rate for the lira. Recently, when Biden was elected instead of Trump, who was happy to accommodate Erdogan on a number of fronts, this also made the international environment a little less conducive to what Erdogan wanted to do. And of course, it corresponded with a renewed enthusiasm amongst the Turkish opposition, in part driven by the state of the Turkish economy, increasing criticism of Erdogan from former coalition partners of his. And so far, right, Erdogan realized that international tensions, which, you know, at times have been very good for him politically, and which I suspect in the future he may decide are once again good for him politically. At the current stage over the past year, particularly with such an emphasis on the economy, yeah, as you suggested, Erdogan did decide that calming things down, trying to keep the economy on track, trying to maintain the illusion at least that Turkey was going to go back to a more conciliatory policy, get back on good terms with the United States and the West, that the threat of sanctions from Washington and Europe was going to go away. You know, Erdogan had an incentive to try to promote this positive narrative to help offset, you know, again, particularly the economic challenges he was facing and the political challenges that came along with that. And, you know, it's worth saying, you know, it certainly hasn't been successful. You know, again, we've seen what's been happening to the Turkish lira recently, but you know, he's avoided a major crisis, which in itself, you know, given the way things were going, is something of an accomplishment. And my prediction going forward, based on all this, is that so long as he thinks there's a possibility of maintaining some kind of status quo, so long as he thinks he can keep the economy from really going off a cliff, he may continue to pursue more conciliatory policies vis-a-vis Washington, vis-a-vis Turkey's neighbors. The risk, I think, is if it gets to a point where that approach doesn't work, where, you know, the economy does hit a crisis that he can't handle, where, you know, he faces, one way or another, he faces actually having to have an election, having to lose an election, having to cancel an election, some bigger test of his power. And then, you know, we've seen how he plays the nationalist card in the past. That's the moment when he might revert to some of the antagonistic policies that we're all too familiar with.
While Turkey's rivals haven't really embraced rapprochement with the same zeal as Ankara, you write that they too have reasons to respond to these overtures. Can you give us some more details? You know, what reasons do Egypt and the Gulf states, for example, have to be open to these overtures from Ankara? And are some more receptive than others?
I mean, clearly some have been more receptive to others. You know, when you're dealing with other authoritarian regimes in the region, when you're dealing with countries like the UAE, which have pursued their own aggressive policies around the region, you know, they were facing some of the same calculations as Turkey was. You know, I guess we saw this really come to a head in Libya the summer before last, and we should actually talk more about the Libya situation as it results in this. But, you know, there was a moment when it looked like Turkey and Egypt could be headed for a real conflict in Libya. But, you know, I think it was for the same reason that Erdogan, you know, much as he likes the prospect of conflict, much as he likes picking fights abroad that he can win, Turkey had reason to fear that a direct military confrontation that didn't go the way Erdogan wanted could be bad for his domestic political standing. And I think, you know, Sisi and Egypt had the same concerns. And so in that sense, both autocratic leaders benefited from the tensions, but didn't necessarily benefit from an actual military clash that might get out of control.
Can you expand on the Libya angle here? Because I know you focus a great deal on it in your briefing for El Yamab.
Yes, and that's been a big part of it, and a part that I'm hesitant to talk quite as much about because domestic dynamics in Libya are enormously complicated, and I'm by no means an expert on them. But it does seem like since summer before last, when you did have this real fear of direct military confrontation between Turkish and Egyptian-backed forces, there's been a peace process in Libya leading to an uncertain political process that both facilitated the rapprochement between Turkey and countries like Egypt and the UAE, but was also facilitated by that rapprochement. You know, and again, not being an expert on Libyan domestic politics, it certainly seems like once the Tripoli-based government with Turkish military support had defeated Field Marshal Haftar's attempt to take Tripoli, there was a stasis on the ground. You know, before there was a ceasefire, there was actually a military stalemate. And at that point, all actors in the Libyan conflict realized that a process that created some semblance of national unity, more importantly, got oil flowing again, could create opportunities for both sides. And so international actors, Western, also Turkey and Russia, took advantage of that, helped create, you know, again, what was initially a ceasefire on the ground, which then got rolled into a complicated political process leading to, you know, you originally had the government of national accord, which was originally intended to be a government of national accord and then became one of the parties in the conflict. Now you have the creation of a new government of national unity. It's not by any means a coherent, strong, centralized government, but it's created enough of a framework for the fighting to stop and for some level of, you know, again, specifically economic activity to continue. You know, and it was also supposed to build to an actual elections on December 24th. That did not happen. That may have been an overly ambitious goal from the beginning. There were concerns on all sides about how that was going to play out. Now that election has been postponed, seemingly indefinitely. And so far, at least, you know, there are concerns about what that might lead to. There are concerns about how the current ceasefire slash peace process slash political process could break down. But so far, at least, it seems like the domestic actors and their international backers are happy to maintain the status quo, even in the absence of elections.
Nicholas, looking ahead, how do you see this evolving, particularly in the Eastern Mediterranean, where countries have been strengthening their cooperation through different trilateral schemes, institutions like the East Med Gas Forum, and defense deals and exercises that bring in France and the Gulf states into the picture?
And that's getting back to your first question. I mean, that's what I'd emphasize, that Turkey's rapprochement has managed to calm tensions, but it hasn't reversed what, you know, I think from Ankara's point of view is the most alarming dynamic, which is that through a lot of its provocative actions, it was remarkably effective in bringing together, you know, what you describe, namely at various coalitions of other powers that were alarmed by what Turkey was doing. You know, and so the improved relations between Greece, Cyprus, Egypt, Israel, you know, whatever actually happens to the idea of the Eastern Med Gas pipeline itself, that coalition, that cooperation, the economic side, the diplomatic side, the military side of that cooperation is real and continuing. And then, as you alluded to most dramatically, the Greek-French defense deal, you know, with its strategic implications, with the weapons sales that go along with it, that happened. That's real. And that's, you know, people in Ankara are loath to admit it, but that's also, you know, a direct result of Turkish policies. And even as Turkey's tried to tone down some of those policies, you know, the impact of them, for good or bad, remains.
Nicholas, if you're a policymaker in a European capital or in Washington, D.C., what advice or what recommendations would you give to governments seeking to deal with, you know, the challenges posed by Turkey's foreign policy?
You know, and so far, well, they're not great solutions. I mean, that's what I always emphasize when I'm asked this. You know, I think slowly, very gradually, I think Europe, the EU, came to a recognition that it had to be a little more forceful in dealing with Turkey's provocations. You know, the fact that in response to some of the Orochres drilling activity, you know, the EU actually threatened, albeit very minor, sanctions, it was a step in the right direction. The Biden administration, likewise, you know, I think it's done a good job. It's at least nominally criticized Turkey for human rights abuses. It hasn't gone out of its way to try to accommodate Turkey on anything. You know, I think it's been happy to kind of ignore Turkey and focus on other things, which, given that Turkey's been willing to keep things calm, seems like the right approach. I mean, the real challenge coming up, in part, is that with Erdogan destroying his economy as quickly as possible on his own, there is going to be limited room for Western powers to use sanctions. I'm not, you know, at the point where the United States, and particularly Europe, doesn't actually want to see Turkey's economy crash. I think we're entering a period where, yes, threatening sanctions is going to have a major impact, but there's also going to be a lot of hesitation for fear that those threats will have too much of an impact. You know, so I think staying the course is the best thing that the United States and Europe can do right now. You know, again, conditioned on the fact that Turkey is not going out of its way to antagonize anyone. And, you know, I'd make it clear, as Washington certainly has, that any improvement in relations is going to require, you know, kind of real steps, not just rhetoric on Turkey's part. You know, not go out of anyone's way to further antagonize Turkey, but basically make it clear that the ball's in Ankara's court, and that if, you know, if Erdogan wants real improvements with his neighbors, or wants the kind of moves from the U.S. or the EU that really would help turn Turkey's economy around, not that I think Erdogan necessarily does, but then that will require real concessions from Turkey, you know, on foreign policy and ideally also on, you know, democracy and human rights at home.
Nicholas, thanks for joining us again on The Greek Current. Great speaking with you.
Always a delight.
In other news, Turkey distorts the reality when it comes to its past, Greece said on Thursday, responding to Turkey's foreign ministry, which chided President Katerina Sakellaropoulou for mentioning the genocide of Pontic Greeks. Meanwhile, during a meeting with EU ambassadors in Ankara on Thursday, President Erdogan said that Turkey remains committed to full membership in the European Union, for which it is a candidate country. He added that certain countries, which he did not name, were seeking to undermine Turkey's bid. Referring to tensions between Greece and Turkey, Erdogan said he believes differences between the two countries can be solved through direct and constructive dialogue. Finally, Greece's government is eyeing the creation of 86,000 new jobs this year, using funds from the European Union as well as national resources, Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis said on Wednesday. The goal of the programs, Mitsotakis said, is extremely ambitious. He added that the new job positions will be created with resources that will come from the Recovery Fund and from ESPA, referring to the EU's multi-annual financial framework for 2021 to 2027. In the meantime, Greece's consumer price index surged to 5.1% in December last year, compared to the corresponding month of 2020, as the cost of natural gas soared by 135.7%, according to official data from the Hellenic Statistical Authority. That wraps up today's episode of The Greek Current. Thanks for tuning in.